The Friday edition of the Large Morning Show in the afternoon. I'm a Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris. Ian and Dan are here with me, and John Max is on the phone now. If you've listened to my show through the years, you've heard John on the air. Not only has he been a contributor to my radio shows, but he also was there with Jay Leno writing jokes for The Tonight Show from the moment Jay took over. In fact, he worked for Jay even before Jay took over full-time in February of 1992. And he was there through both times Jay had a finale on that show, including the last one in February of last year. Now he writes about that experience and the experience of writing on 18 Oscars telecasts and the Emmys and the Tonys and the Golden Globes and the always coveted World Stunt Awards, and not to mention last Sunday's huge Academy of Country Music Awards in Dallas at the Cowboys Stadium, which I know, John, because you're from Philadelphia, as an Eagles fan, probably made you sick just being in that room, didn't it?
It was killing me. Luckily, I was down there for other events. I also wrote for the Fliegelman Bar Mitzvah the day before, which was really good. But it just killed me to be there. And then to have to write for Tony Romo and make him look good, I believe the word is sickened. I was sickened.
But that's the way you are. You'll write for anybody, won't you?
Well, you know something? I wouldn't define it that narrowly. Anything or anybody. It doesn't have to be a person.
In the book, you say that, by the way, the book is called Monologue, What Makes America Laugh Before Bed. And it's not only a great look at what's happened in late night television for the last couple of decades, but also pretty good insight into what is going to happen as things change so much this year. But in the book, John, you say that you wrote a half a million jokes for Jay Leno.
Yeah, it's, you know, I did the math because I'm, as you know me for so long, you know I'm a baseball statistic numbers freak. And so Jay did 4,610 shows, and I wrote about 100 jokes a day for the monologue, and there was probably 10 to 15 other jokes written for sketches that were going to be on that night. Throw in a Sunday when you send another 50 or so to prime the pump for Monday's monologue. I figured it was 500,000. And they told me afterwards that I had 18,000 in the air, which I prefer to look at. That meant 482,000 jokes are in a landfill.
What happened to those jokes?
They just thrown out. Because, since it's a topical monologue, there's really not anything that can be reused. Although, you know, the Shannon Doherty jokes of the 1990s, of course, became the Paris Hilton jokes, became the Lindsay Lohan jokes. It's just the interchangeable names.
Explain the process that you would go through each day to write jokes for the monologue. And you said you wrote 100 a day. How did that work?
You know, I get up, around 6:30 in the morning and start just looking at the different websites, read the LA Times, read a couple newspapers, and just start to get an idea of what was going on out there. On the ride in, while I was driving, I would never text and drive. I would actually handwrite, which made me even more dangerous.
Wow.
I would sit down, because the 101, as you know, has no traffic in LA.
Oh, no, there's no traffic in Los Angeles.
So, and I'd write down 9 topics, and it was a very arbitrary number, but I, like today, for example, we would say the big topics would be, the Hillary and her fundraising problems, and it might be Loretta Lynch gets confirmed, and it might be, Paul Blart to win Best Picture, and so, you'd write down those topics, and then I would just start doing association between the two. That gets you up to about 50, 60 jokes, where you just write something, 2 or 3 on 4 or 5 on each topic, cross-reference. Then I would go to the what I call the formula jokes. It's so hot, it's so cold, the economy's so bad, gas prices are so high. Whatever big topic was in the news, and you do like a run of short jokes. Then you go to the weird stories. A man in Belgium fell into a wood chipper.
Mm-hmm.
Type story.
Yep.
And they're making a movie about him. Goodbye, Mr. Chips. That kind of stuff. you get a bunch of quick jokes, and then you get up to about 90, and then the last hour of the day, I'd really start to do, I'll call them the smarter jokes, where you're really getting into twist, punchline, twist again, punchline, and move on. And
so,
that gets you to about 100.
So like me, in the days when I was doing a daily radio show, you'd wake up every morning and say, please let there be enough stupid people doing enough stupid things in the world so I can keep my job.
In an ideal world, on any given day, a drunken senator would get onto a flight with a hooker. that a drunken airline pilot would land safely, and as they would get out of the plane, Arnold Schwarzenegger would be there cavorting with a maid. If that happened, I would die a happy
day. Speaking of Schwarzenegger, you were there on the night that he surprised everybody by announcing that he was going to run for governor of California, something that you write in the book, not only did you not know, Jay didn't know, and Arnold's people didn't know.
I was I had been called from time to time by Arnold to write what he called chokes. I need some chokes. I'm doing a roast of Tom Arnold. You know Tom Arnold. You know, he would, and so he called me up and he said, I'm coming on the show to talk about governor. I said, well, how do you want me to write them? And he said, I'm not running. Okay. So I wrote a bunch of jokes about him not running, and he came on, and I was convinced he was going to endorse Dick Reardon. And he goes through and he tells this joke about getting a bikini wax, which is not a joke you normally would do if you're about to announce for the, you know, for governor of California.
Although it is California.
It is California. And, you know, actually just count the pro-bikini wax vote. That's about 68%. It's a landslide.
Yeah.
By the way, just to remember, that election was, by the end, the ballot was Gary Coleman, Gallagher, Angeline, and Mary Carey, the porn star. It looked like the bottom row of a bad Hollywood Squares episode. So he gets on and he starts to say, and he's building up to the, and I'm convinced as someone who did politics for years, he's about to say, and that is why I'm going to endorse Dick Reardon. He goes, and that is why I am announcing, and he stutters, like a stutter step, and he goes, running for governor of California. And Jay slumps back like, what? Kevin Eubanks looks like, oh my God. And I turn around, I'm with his political consultant, and the consultant turns completely pale.
This is Arnold's consultant.
Arnold's political consultant, who was there, we thought, obviously, and I thought, to just ease him out of the race. And the consultant looks at me and goes, we need two things right away. Can you help us? I said, what do you need? He goes, we need a press room. Well, normally if you're about to announce for governor, it would seem that you would have everything set up.
Yeah, you'd prep for that.
And then he said, and we need a private room where Arnold can call Maria. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, Maria doesn't know. And then later on I found out there was a lot of things she didn't know. She didn't know about running for governor.
I wonder if the maid knew.
I'm going to guess. You know, it was pregnant with possibilities. But it was, and I'm convinced to that day that, you know, when Arnold saw the audience cheering and how nuts they were going and they were wild for him, because remember, this was, you know, our Terminator hero at the time.
Yeah.
I think he decided mid-sentence. The only other thing, Paul, was, or he's such a good showman, he kept a secret from everybody.
Yeah, no, I don't think he is.
Let's not put it this way. He didn't quite win Best Actor yet. Oh, just leave it at that.
Now, let me ask you, as a Californian, or a Californian, as he would say, how did that whole governor thing work out?
You know, he was, I mean, the truth is, when you look at Arnold's policies and the truth is, he's really almost like he's a moderate Democrat. And so he was always fighting, you know, two battles. He was fighting the battles with the conservative Republicans in the legislature. And he's also fighting a battle with liberal Democrats. So in the end, he ended up kind of being a tax and spend, and the state kind of ended up with, I think our deficit is $19 trillion at this point or something like that.
Yeah.
I'm sure
he can get that
well.
Yeah, I'm sure he can get that back. Talking with John Max, who wrote for Jay Leno for 22 years and has a book about his experiences called Monologue, What Makes America Laugh Before Bed. You were talking before about the kind of jokes and how you wrote jokes for Jay and giving him 100 a day and then he would winnow them down. Would a joke you wrote for Jay also work for Dave or Jimmy or Jimmy or any of the others?
I think a lot of the jokes, the truth are when it comes to the late-nighters, are pretty interchangeable. I don't know if they'd necessarily work for Jimmy Fallon because his style is so different. But, I mean, if you took the topic and the punchline and you put it in Jimmy Fallon's voice or in Dave's voice, I mean, you know, I think they would work. What they don't do is people always say, well, you also work for, you know, Marty Short and Billy Crystal and Chris Rock. that's totally different. The topic works for them, but the punchline and the twist would be completely different.
So the late night host might be interchangeable, but you also wrote for 18 Academy Award shows, and the hosts are not interchangeable.
Exactly, and that's also really different, Paul, as you know, because it's not a topical. You know, when a Billy Crystal or a Chris Rock or Steve Martin comes out at the top of the Oscars, it's not topical. They're talking about the movies and the event and the people in the audience. Now, you might have a topical punchline. You might say, movie X reminds me of this that's topical in the news, but the setup's never going to be topical or anything. It's all going to be about the event and the event itself. And that's, I think, where the great Oscar hosts get it. They make it about the show, and the hosts that haven't done as well tend to make it a little bit more about themselves or do what they traditionally do in their regular jobs.
And speaking of great Oscar hosts, John has written for Billy Crystal and Steve Martin and Chris Rock and, of course, the best of them all, James Franco.
Well, there's, you know, again, I was fortunate that year in that I didn't, I was, you know, there's show writers and there's host writers, and sometimes you write both. So for Steve and Chris and Billy, I was a show writer and a host writer. For that year of 2011, I was hired as a show writer. I got brought in to try and help in the last few days before the telecast. But they were, you know, the way I always put it, Paul, is this: you need a comic to host a show like that.
Mm-hmm.
You need a total entertainer like a Hugh Jackman, an actor. And actors and people who are used to multiple takes and lines and not being live in the moment, that's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, and it could be fine if you do an award show where there isn't somebody who's going to come out there and try to be the opening entertainer, but is really just going to be more of an MC. That's worked many times on different broadcasts. But for the Oscars in particular, you do need that full-time person who's comfortable out there in one at the center of the stage.
Exactly. You know, again, there's a lot of shows where you can have a traffic cop. You know what I mean? It's, you know, welcome to the whatever People's Choice Awards, and, you know, we're going to get right to it. Here's our first presenter. I get that. But, again, and especially since Billy set the bar so high, you know, for so many years, and, you know, that, you know, you'd have an opening movie, you'd have a monologue, you'd have songs. People came to expect 10 to 12 minutes of, you know, sheer entertainment. And when they get 2 minutes of people who aren't really comfortable in that role, it really doesn't work well.
I mentioned that you were there with Jay from even before he took over as the full-time host, and you were there right through the end, and then the other end, because he was yanked off the air there in 2009 for Conan O'Brien, and then there was that Jay at 10, or as we in the Midwest call it, the Jay at 9 experiment. You were part of that as well. What do you remember about it?
I don't remember a single thing.
You're lying.
Yeah, I am lying. No, it was, you know, again, when coming into it, you know, Jay was born for late night. He was born for The Tonight Show. That was the thing. And he, you know, he did what, you know, he gave it his best, but he wasn't allowed to be Jay. You know, it was like, look, we're doing The Tonight Show with Conan, and I don't think NBC really let Conan do what he does best, and I don't think they let Jay do what he does best, and I think things settled down to where they should, as I'll call it, rightfully be. You know, Jay went back to The Tonight Show. Conan has his own very good show on TBS. You know, and everyone else has a late night show right now except for the two of us.
Yeah, that's right. And what do you think of the changing landscape of late night? You've got David Letterman, who's going off the air in just a few weeks. You've got Jon Stewart, who's going to hang it up on August 6th. Stephen Colbert is coming in. Trevor Noah is going to take over for Jon Stewart. Jay gave way to Jimmy last year. I mean, this is a big change from where it was just 2 years ago.
Exactly. I mean, you know, there was, you know, we grew up, you know, although both of us are 30 years old, Paul, we both grew up on Johnny Carson.
Right.
And then there was Jay and Dave, and that was what dominated. And even the shows afterwards, you know, they were the ones that everyone judged by and what they called the late night wars or whatever. But we knew there was two. And now, you know, I actually think it's a good thing. You know, there's not going to ever be a day again where 10 million people watch, you know, one late night show. but there's something for everybody. If you like more variety sketch comedy and great celebrity interactions, you're going to watch Jimmy Fallon. If you want more of a traditional monologue, you might watch Seth Meyers or Conan.
No, nobody's watching Seth Meyers.
Okay, there you go. If you, I said Mike. If you, you know, if you want political, do you know what I mean? You're going to watch Bill Maher, or you're going to watch Jon Stewart for a little while longer, and you know, I'm going to go out on a limb. The one thing I think the game changer, Paul, is going to be Stephen Colbert, because I don't know who he is. I know what he was.
Yeah.
I know what a great actor he is playing that character. But what's that show going to be like? Is it going to be Carson-esque? Is it going to be Letterman-esque? You know, that to me, he could come on and completely redefine it again, just as Jimmy has.
I think he may come on and just interview guests for 5 or 6 minutes and then play games. Oh, wait.
There you go.
Somebody's already doing that. And what do you, as a Tonight Show veteran, think of the current Tonight Show?
You know, it's obviously it's different. And you know, I don't want to be one of those old guys say, you know, back in the day when we had a V4 engine, you know what I mean? It's and you know, again, that's the car analogy. Leno, by the way, told me you know nothing about cars. Never put the word car in a joke.
Yeah, if he hears this interview, he'll go, there was never a V4. What are you talking about?
Yeah, the 67 Buick everyone knows was a V74. What, huh?
Wait a minute.
Yeah. So,
that's the imitation that John. That right there is the Jay Leno imitation John never did while working for Jay Leno.
Oh, but you know what, Ian sitting in here, John, does a pretty good Jay Leno too.
Here's the best Leno. Tell Ian that the best Leno would be to send me a large check every Thursday.
Yeah, no, I can't do that.
22 years.
He's right.
I can't do that.
Go ahead, Ian. Give him a little.
And then, Jonathan, yeah, there was never such thing as a V4. I'm sorry. I'm trying to tell you.
Are you sure that's not Leno there?
But I wanted to ask you, while we're talking about the changing of late night, you know, Letterman's going through this long goodbye now. And again, if you're old enough to remember Carson's long goodbye, that was a goodbye to the real king of late night. And while Letterman was a paradigm changer who even gave Jay Leno his boost by letting him appear on the old NBC show, Letterman's, as let's be frank, been phoning it in for years now. And you know, it seems like he can't really relate to a lot of the young stars who are coming on there, and he doesn't really care about that. And I'm curious, especially last year before Jay was forced out for the second time from The Tonight Show, did he go through any of that where it's just like, okay, let's just get this over with. Let's not make a big deal about it.
You know, it's interesting. It's a great question. And the thing is, Jay is so businesslike and matter-of-fact. So, I mean, I honestly think that if Jay had had his way, he would have done that last show and then just said, okay, thanks, everybody, see ya. You know, and caught the plane to go do the Foxwoods Casino. You know what I mean? Which basically is what he did. But, you know, obviously NBC wanted a big farewell, and there was a lot of people who wanted to make a big fuss. And Jay has never been one. He never, think about it. We did one anniversary show. We did a 10th anniversary show. And networks love anniversary shows because it's a way to, you know, build up. It's a primetime thing. It's great. We did one. Jay said, I don't want to do an anniversary show. And to me, in the end, I think he would have been very content to just go out, have some, you know, maybe have those guests he liked best, which he did on that last show, and caught out. But that whole 4 or 5 week, you're in the final 22 shows now, the countdown, that's really not him.
Yeah. Was it painful for you to see the clock ticking down?
It was painful for me when every Thursday they stopped walking a check into my office and putting it in my desk. That was painful and really upsetting.
But the good news about you, and I know you for a long time, is you're such a hustler that you have continued to work on so many different projects, including the inimitable lip sync battle that Jimmy Fallon is doing on Spike TV on Thursday nights, where you have to write ad libs that we don't even get to see from Chrissy Teigen.
You know, hold on one second. I'm working a lemonade stand right now outside my house. Hold on. Yeah, three cups of sugar. The answer to the question is what I miss Jay every day. You know what I mean? I miss that interaction because he's, as you've known me say for years, what you see is what you get. One of the nicest guys in the world, a guy whose door was literally and figuratively always open. I also miss when you wake up and you see that someone else has jumped the White House fence.
Yeah.
You know, I miss when you see Hillary carrying her own bags through the airport.
Yep.
You know, I'm saying, okay, I got a good 40 jokes on those two things. Oh, wait, I have nowhere to send them. And so that I miss to a degree. And, you know, because in the end, when you're doing award shows, you're writing for, you know, comics, you know, like, a, you know, a Billy Crystal or a Steve or whatever, it's not topical, and it's a different type of writing.
Well, years and years of award shows, 22 years writing monologue jokes for Jay Leno, plus a few months writing jokes for me, seven-time Emmy nominee, and as Chris Rock says, one of the greatest comedy writers of all time. The book is called Monologue, What Makes America Laugh Before Bed. John Max, always great to have you back on the show.
It's great talking, Paul. I loved it.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.